Hi, and welcome to the Chat TCG podcast. I am Paula Sabaga, financial advisor with TCG and Associates at UBS Financial Services. We are located in Columbia, South Carolina, and I can be reached at 803-873-9850. Today, our guest is William Starrett, Chief Executive Officer and Artistic Director at the South Carolina Ballet. He is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and his views are his own. Well, good morning, William. We're here with William Starrett, CEO of the South Carolina Ballet. Thank you for being on our podcast today.
Thank you, Paula. Good morning. It's great to see you.
Yeah, we're so excited. My family and my colleagues, we love the ballet and have been to it for years. So I'm so excited to have the chance to be here with you.
Well, thank you.
So you have been associated with the ballet since 1977 and became artistic director in 1986. How has your vision evolved over those years?
Early on, I just saw the potential for a ballet company in South Carolina. I moved here from Manhattan, and I figured there are only 50 states, and the capital of this one should have a good ballet company. And then our founding director, Ann Brody, had already established this love for the art, for dance. You know, many of the female dancers, they wanted to be in the ballet company rather than be a cheerleader. And so I just saw that she had already really established a love and passion for the art, and I just saw the potential. You know, I was a little naive in that, you know, this is a Republican state and it is sports centric, but maybe that naivety didn't work as a blockade for my vision. So I just powered through.
Right. Wow. Well, it's incredible. Look what it's become today.
So the largest performing arts organization in South Carolina.
Wow.
So that's just pretty amazing that it's dance and ballet. You know, I think what can be harder to sell in the sports-centric South than classical ballet?
That's true, right here with the Gamecocks.
Yeah. So I think, you know, people discovering the quality and the, you know, changing the perception of what ballet is and can be has been really exciting.
Yes. Very good. What draws you to some of the stories that you've turned into ballets, such as Dracula, one of my personal favorites, or Frankenstein or Cleopatra?
Well, I think here in Columbia, what I've learned is that because they're not as familiar with the art form, that you have to sell something that they can relate to, like the word Cleopatra, like they don't know Balanchine or La Femme Garde or Les Sylphides. So I had to be very clever in marketing because the audience is not as familiar. So I gave the audience Le Bayadere, but they think it's Aladdin.
Right.
So I used the Aladdin story that was so popular by the Disney market, but it's Bayadere music, and it's a Bayadere theme, and it's Bayadere steps in certain ways, but it does unfold and tell the fantastic story of Aladdin. And then the same with Esmeralda, with the Hunchback of Notre Dame. So the Hunchback was very popular, but they learned the famous classical ballet of Esmeralda. And then I'm sort of was frustrated by some of the restrictions in like New York, where like when we did Aladdin or Bayadere, I had a real snake, not a rubber plastic snake like they have in New York. And then in Esmeralda, I had a real goat.
Right.
Because that's just the way I hang. So, and that really appeals to the people.
Yes.
Also like in the Nutcracker, a lot of people around the states, they're like, oh, we hate Nutcracker and we have to do Nutcracker again. They dread it. But to me, it's an amazing opportunity for people to discover the art. And I approach it fresh and new and different. And I know that people are going to come to see ballet during the holidays and hopefully they discover the quality. And so I really work at making it unique and amazing quality every year. And then I'm always adding to it. For instance, Clara arrives in the land of the sweets on a real unicorn.
Right.
And what little girl isn't going to just go crazy? What can be better than Clara and the land of the sweets meeting the sugarplum fairy riding a real unicorn?
Right.
So I really try to think out of the box. And, you know, the holidays are a great time for everyone. And so I, you know, it just isn't Christmas until you see the Nutcracker.
That's so true. And as a dance mom, it's still just as magical for me to see it. And my daughter dances. She's 15. And we've seen a lot of Nutcrackers in a lot of cities, and even in New York. But Columbia has one of the best ones. And we are very lucky to have you here, and the quality of the performance. It's incredible.
Well, thank you. You know, I was deemed by Dance Magazine the ultimate Nutcracker Prince when I was performing. And I performed for 40 different ballet companies around the world as the Nutcracker Prince. And so I brought all the best parts of those productions that I was a part of or that I witnessed. And I have a treasure trove of versions that I can bring to Columbia. And I change it up every year a little bit and continue to make it special. So it's not a drudgery at Christmas. It's an opportunity.
Right. How do you balance respecting the original creation with adding your own creative voice to it?
Our production is based on the original Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. That's what Diaghilev brought from Russia at the turn of the century, you know, around 1907. And the one that Diaghilev and Danilova did on the trains here in the United States right before the San Francisco Ballet was founded. So it's an original Ballet Russe production. So the snow scene, the snow pas de deux, and of course the Sugarplum Fairy variation, you can't touch. You can't mess around with that. But I tweaked the Russian dance and the Arabian dance, and I changed the numbers. You know, sometimes a Russian or Spanish will be a duet, and sometimes it'll be four women. And the Candy Canes might be three women, or maybe four. It's been as many as six. So it just keeps it fresh and different. And then I was very inspired by John Neumeier's version in Hamburg of the first act, because what's really boring in a lot of first acts is there's not enough dancing. And so John Neumeier made Clara's older sister, Louisa, have friends. And so then he also has the military school who can't go home for Christmas invited to the Stahlbaum's party. So that was a great opportunity for my male dancers to get to actually dance. And what I hated was I would have 20-year-olds acting like they were 40 or 50-year-old men,
right,
as party parents. So that just never felt realistic to me. So I have real actors and people in the community. They're in their 40s and 50s that are actually the fathers. And then the young dancers in their 20s and early 30s can be the cadets. And then the original version here in Columbia, it was really built as a school was being built. And the tap department would be dancing soldiers in the first act. And I hated that. I couldn't figure out, first of all, why they're women acting like soldiers, and their costumes are crisscrossed across their chest. So that was not helping the male dancer stigma. And then why are there 16 tap dancers in the turn of the century, 1800s, first act party scene? So that was a major change I made to Ann Brody's production. And so it was my job to create change and make change when I took over as the artistic director, and improving and bringing the Nutcracker up to today's standard was just part of my job. And it used to be, unfortunately, as we're building the company, that you had to fill the stage with children, and then their parents would come, and then that would sell tickets. Well, we've passed that, in that we have no children in Charleston or Savannah, and very few children in the Columbia production. And they're seeing the production as a family outing rather than a recital. So that's really evolved.
Right.
We completely sold out in Savannah last year, 2,500 people.
Wow.
With, you know, very few children in the production. And then in Savannah, in Charleston, there's no children in the production. It's all professional company members. And we're selling out three performances. So those early days of making a recital have passed us. You know, I do, of course, have children and children-appropriate roles like the mice and the cherubs and the bonbons. It's not necessary anymore to fill the audience with parents.
Right.
So that's profoundly different and very exciting for the company.
Yeah, that is very exciting. And the puppy, my puppy Leo, was in the performance. So I know that's always a hit to have the live animals.
Yes. And who doesn't love a puppy dog?
That's right.
And that's Fritz's best friend. So that's really, really important.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a great time. Looking at the educational reach of ballet, you've created 21 educational outreach ballets, reaching 750,000 children. What goes into designing a ballet that will also educate while entertaining?
Most ballet companies around the United States is pretty clever. They have the children come to their Nutcracker, and that pays for the dress rehearsal. Well, I just felt that that wasn't particularly educational, and that children aren't ready to sit for 2 hours when they're not with their parents, and they're not in their church clothes, and they're not understanding that this is a outing with their family. And there's so many issues, especially education in South Carolina are so important, that I felt needed addressing. And so I created the different ballets. Like, one is holiday celebrations around the world. So I felt it was important they learn how all the different countries celebrate the holidays. That was one that was really important. And then I created Goldilocks and the Three Bees, Bach, Beethoven, and Beyonce.
Oh, right.
And so, you know, the children want to come because of the excitement of Beyonce music, but they're learning about Bach and Beethoven. They're also learning the Goldilocks story, and they're learning it's okay not to break into someone else's house.
Right, right.
And so forth and so on. And so many of the ballets approach the bullying syndrome, like Ferdinand the Bull.
Right.
And so I wanted to bring ballets that were what children were reading today, and that really helped teachers. You know, there's so many different ways of learning. So, and all of our performances come with a teacher's guide and a workbook, and it has question and answer before and after the performances. So it's really a learning tool. It's been very, very successful. And I just knew early on that education was a huge part of our mission. I wanted the children to come to the opera house, because for many of them, that's the only opportunity they get to see the performance. And I didn't want to go to a cafetorium or their classroom where they didn't get the full effect of lighting and the stagecraft. And I don't have students performing for the children. I have the full-fledged company members. So the first exposure to dance and to ballet is a real positive, exciting one. And for every child that comes to the performance, they get a coloring page, and that's also a learning tool. And when they color that, they can bring that back to the box office, and they get a free ticket to the Nutcracker, to the evening performances, and in the spring to whatever evening performance we happen to be doing, if they're accompanied by an adult. And so that way, through the children, the adults are learning, and they're also able to come as a family. And so providing wonderful family entertainment for the Midlands and for the people of South Carolina was just a really important part of my mission.
Yeah, you're right. A lot of those children, that would be their first and maybe only experience to a full theater performance. So how exciting they get to dress up and have the full experience.
That's right.
I love it.
Yeah, and the teachers enjoy it, and especially because they're really, really learning, not just sort of being brought in and watching a dress rehearsal with no explanation of anything.
Right, right. Looking at the branding, so since the company rebranded as the South Carolina Ballet and expanded statewide touring in 2023, how has that influenced your approach to your programming? Are you trying to reach new audiences? Tell us about that.
Well, I'm always trying to reach new audiences. And I've wanted to be the South Carolina Ballet for many years because it's really who we are. We're the largest touring organization, arts organization in the state. We had performed in 7 states that particular year. And our marketing was so challenging because it was so lengthy. We had to say, this Columbia City Ballet of South Carolina performing off the wall onto the stage, dancing the arms on whatever the ballet happened right. to be. So it was so wordy. And there are 19 different Columbias in the United States.
Right.
And so it was so confusing. And we really wanted South Carolina to get the credit. And so it just made sense that we become the South Carolina Ballet. And we, throughout the state, we performed in more than 50 cities of South Carolina. And we continue, like we're in, next year we're in 14 cities. So it just really represents who we are more clearly. And also the city of Columbia had cut our funding substantially. So I felt that was the year that maybe I should make a change.
Yeah.
And it's also opened up not public funding, because our public funding is only available where we're based. So I still am very relying on Richland County and the city of Columbia for our public funding. But it did open up for ticket sales in other cities and for individual gifts from individuals in other cities.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So, you know, we're still based in the capital on Main Street in the center of our state, but now we represent Columbia is our heart, but we're serving the entire state.
Let's talk a little bit about behind the scenes. So in your daily role, so you're CEO as well as artistic director. So how do you juggle the artistic side with rehearsals and choreography with the administrative responsibililities of running a nonprofit?
Well, I have a fantastic staff, a fantastic team. And I just learned early on, we had some managing directors, but they weren't working as hard as I wanted them to. And I learned early on that you couldn't spend it if you couldn't earn it or if it wasn't available.
Right.
And so I would be limited by the board or the managing directors. And they said, well, you just can't afford that. And so then I would go out and I said, well, we have to have that. And I would raise the money. So we lost a managing director at one point, and I was asked to be the executive director through the summer, and I cleared a $53,000 deficit and, you know, was successful with that. So then they asked me to stay on for a year, and then I became the executive director and the artistic director, and now recently the CEO, just mainly because I enjoy the numbers, and I think today there's no successful arts organization if the leader doesn't have a financial mindset of how important it is to be responsible financially. And so any thriving arts organization, you have to be very cognizant of the financial. And I think I'm in the unique position that I can see the full picture of all the branches of the company and what they need at any given time in terms of support financially or any other way. And so I work very hard in the off season at raising the money and keeping relationships with leaders of our state. And then my day is complicated. I start early in the morning administratively, and then I'm with the company from about 10:30 to 3:30. And then I'm with the administration again until 5:30. And then I'm in the school until 8 or 8:30.
So do you ever sleep?
I schedule sleep between 11 and 7. So I'm a full believer. Anything's possible through scheduling.
Yes. Yes. I agree. Yeah. And like you mentioned, it is so important for a leader to know the financial side, to see how each activity through the day translates into the balance sheet. So I think that is definitely a key element.
That's right. It's really, really important. And especially balancing, you know, the artistic standard and reaching people. And just, I have a wonderful board too, a wonderful board president. They're very supportive and a great volunteer system. And, you know, a lot of the parents are amazing and I have a terrific staff and just all around the machine is really working. So I feel really, really blessed.
That's wonderful. Thinking about your pipeline, your artistic pipeline, what qualities are you looking for in the young dancers that you see that are coming into the studio? What are you looking for?
Well, the dancer, I can just see immediately that they have a fire and they have a hunger and they have a love for the art. Some students are there because their mothers want them to be there, or they think it's what their friends are doing, or you know, you can tell if there's just this inner passion for the dance, and it's just they have to dance, and they're the kind of dancer that are dancing all day long in the kitchen and their bedrooms, and their and that's what I really look for, that passion and that love for it, and it really comes through, and that's what it takes. You have to just have this drive and passion for it, for anything that you're going to be a success. You know, if you're into animals or architecture or anything you're passionate about, you're not going to be a success if it's just not part of your nature. So that's what I really look for, the hunger and the drive and the love of the art.
Do you have a personal story of someone whose growth in the company inspired you?
Well, many of the dancers, of course, Mary Claire Miranda, the prima ballerina that I performed with for so long. You know, I worked with her and brought her up to the company when she was just 13, 14, 15, 16. And there's been so many, Victoria Chocas, Erin Jaffe, Gillian Murphy, who just performed her final performance. She was reigning principal ballerina with American Ballet Theatre for 23 years. I trained her. Betsy Clark, and currently Claire Richards Rapp, Jordan Hawkins, Nicole Millwood. There's so many that have really inspired me. Regina Willoughby, I discovered and made principal ballerina. You know, I'm inspired daily by the talent in the company, and I have a terrific group right now. We have 24 women and 12 gentlemen starting our 65th anniversary season, and there are many of them that I'm very inspired by. Gabrielle Garner is rising star of the company, and young dancer named Miranda, and she's got the charisma. There's just a lot of really wonderful dancers within the company that, of course, my two principals, Camilo and Joshua Van Dyke, they're wonderful young men that I enjoy working with. So every day, you know, I'm inspired with... Really important to me is being kind and thoughtful and supportive of their fellow dancers. And so that's what's really, really important to me. I try to mentor and teach to company members and to the young dancers coming up that, you know, it's completely opposite of the dance moms. It's just not, right. It's just not realistic. And teamwork and positive spirit for one another is really, really what's key. And that everyone has their gifts and everyone has their time to shine. It just changes. And if it's someone else's time, and then you just want to be really excited for them and happy for them and learning from one another and just being kind is really, really important to the nature and culture of South Carolina Ballet.
Right. And that's such an important life lesson too. You know, we'll all get our turn in the spotlight.
That's right. That's right.
Be a good audience member and support your teammate.
That's right.
So true in so many things.
That's right.
Absolutely. I bet you feel like a proud parent watching all the dancers that have come through and really just gone on to shine.
I do. And my young dancers are having children of their own and they're in the company. And
right.
It's pretty overwhelming at times, but I'm so blessed to be in the art field and surrounded by so much talent.
Yes, yes. So thinking back to your own talent, to your career, looking back, you won a bronze medal at the first United States International Ballet Competition in 1979. How did that moment shape your career as a dancer and now as a director?
Well, what was interesting then is I won that bronze medal without the American vote.
Wow.
And it was the first time there was an international ballet competition in the United States. And so it was all new territory for all of us. And it was very exciting. After I was with the Joffrey Ballet that time, and Mr. Joffrey was the head coach, and so he was unable to vote for me. But after that, every time I performed with the Joffrey, my medal was announced. So that was
very
exciting. And then the company had a European tour canceled. And so I was laid off from work for 8 months.
Oh, wow.
But I was invited to guest because all the judges from around the world had just seen me, and I performed then in 29 countries and with 40 different ballet companies.
Wow.
And that happened for the next 3 years, and I kept going in and out of Ballet Theater, American Ballet Theater, and the Joffrey Ballet, but I got to perform for the Ballet West and Pittsburgh Ballet and Berlin and all over the world. So that was very, very exciting. And it definitely changed my life. My father was there. That was exciting. I was the first American Olympian.
Wow. Yeah.
So, in essence, a ballet. So, that was very exciting.
Congratulations.
Long time ago.
Yes. Yes. And I see all these pictures on your wall. So, great evidence of a fantastic career.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah. For the young choreographers and dancers out there learning ballet and hoping to build a lasting career, what lessons from your long journey would you emphasize for these young people?
I think being really kind and open to learning. I think a lot of young choreographers, they are excited. They want to be choreographers. They don't have a large vocabulary. They're rushing things.
Right.
They're trying to be a creator before they've had much experience.
Right.
And I see that a lot in contemporary and modern dance choreographers. I think that you've got to really put the time in and have a lot of experience before you have much to say.
Right. Not just TikTok videos, right?
Yeah. And I think it's like writing an autobiography at 22.
Right.
You know, it's the same type of thing. So, you know, you've got to put the time in. The whole thing about ballet is investment. So you have to have young children and people in general, you have to have the mentality of investing and spending time. It's not a quick, what do you call it? It is not fast food.
No.
So it is a gourmet meal that you have to spend a lot of time fine-tuning and investing and chopping and, you know, growing the herbs and spices and the best kind of organic food. And that's what you get, a fine, fine meal. So that's what I've learned, is that you really have to have the mentality of investing and seeing a long-term result, not instant mashed potatoes.
Right. And as a dance mom, it's lots of hours driving to and from ballet, lots of buying pointe shoes. And
yes, it's a
big investment.
Huge investment in time and money. But what I try to do as a teacher is teach the ballet dancers the excitement of small benefits.
Right.
You know, I try to point out how they are improving and how there is change and try to instill the excitement on the small bonuses. And again, it's part of understanding that there's an investment. It's hard to look good in ballet right away.
Right.
But we point out the improvement they have made and the small advantages and little improvements. And so.
Right. So celebrate those little wins.
That's right. That's right.
Because I think those do lead to the, you know, there's no big win without looking back and seeing a long history of little wins that led up to that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
So tell us about the future for the South Carolina Ballet. What's next?
You know, just nurturing the dancers and growing the audiences, continuing to tour. I have dreams, of course. I'd love for us to be an international company. And I think in Europe and South America, they would love our Dracula and Off the Wall. And so many of our performances would really appeal in Europe. So that's one dream, is to tour more internationally. And the other dream is we need a more permanent home. So I'm working on that. You know, we love performing at the Coker Center. We're their largest tenant, and we hold all the box office records for any South Carolina performing event. Maybe one day our own theater. We're almost outgrowing Main Street here. So the future is looking at a bigger permanent home for the South Carolina Ballet.
That's very exciting. I look forward to that. Well, very good. Well, thank you for joining us today on the podcast, and we can't wait for the new season to start. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, you're welcome. I can't believe I was here at the 25th anniversary I performed, and now 65th anniversary. It's, you know, the gemstone for 65 is the Sapphire, so it's our Sapphire anniversary season. So we have big ballets in store, and I'm just really, really excited that we can all celebrate the amazing artists that we have here in South Carolina and continue to celebrate the dance through the South Carolina Ballet.
That's wonderful. And where can our listeners go to learn more about the South Carolina Ballet?
They go to southcarolinaballet.com. We have a pretty good website, and we're always keeping up on changes and our latest events, and our touring dates are on there. We're performing 54 times in 14 cities this year. So If we're not in your city, we're right nearby. So we'd love to have you celebrate the art of dance here with South Carolina Ballet during our 65th anniversary season.
Thank you, William.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.